Head to netsuite.com/briefing now for their one-of-a-kind flexible financing program.
Hey, everyone. I'm David Chalian, CNN's political director, and welcome to the CNN Political Briefing. We're going to take a step back this week and zero in on one of the greatest issues in modern American politics, disinformation. Journalist Sasha Eisenberg's new book is called The Lie Detectives, In Search of a Playbook for Winning Elections in the Disinformation Age. It investigates how the failure of traditional campaigning to adapt to the digital age left the door wide open for conspiracies and falsehoods to take root. Sasha's here with me today to talk about what he's learned from his research and whether anyone is combating this disinformation correctly and effectively. Sasha, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, David.
It's a pleasure to get to chat with you in person. You know what a fan I am of your work. And you and I are both old enough to remember in 2008 when the Obama campaign launched their Fight the Smears, which basically was a portal for a press release of pushback on some conspiracy theories that were out there, but nothing more than that. Obviously, the battle against disinformation has ramped up here. And I want you to help build confidence in me that it's actually beatable, because I was recently asked, these campaigns, how do they fight this disinformation? And I kind of threw my arms up and was like, I think it's a losing battle for them. They're always playing catch up. But in your new book, The Lie Detectives, In Search of a Playbook for Winning Elections in the Disinformation Age, you point out there are real strategies in place to actually try and defeat it.
Yeah, I hope you're not counting on me to be solely the bearer of good news here. I think part of it is we need to distinguish what you might think of as good for democracy or good for society in terms of beating back disinformation and what campaigns feel they need to do to advance their strategic interests, right? And so I think we as citizens, as journalists, as people who care about truth writ large should not expect campaigns to solve our disinformation problem. I think they are developing some good tools and tactics for at least navigating the disinformation landscape to serve their interests. And so some of the problems are the same as they were in 2008, which I revisit this a little bit in the book, how the Obama campaign first thought about this. This is the beginning of, look, people have been lying in politics forever. They were lying before we had electricity. After we got telephones, they lied in robocalls. After we got the photocopier, they lied with, you know, mimeographed papers. Like, let's not pretend that there was a sort of pre-lying era in politics. But what's happened is that the internet has reduced many of the barriers to entry to get a lie at scale and its scope. And for people who are not sort of part of the normal political process, who aren't regulated by the Federal Election Commission, who aren't operating under any part of the tax code, who might not even be in the United States, to very quickly and cheaply launch lies that can get a lot of reach. But the problem for the Obama campaign in 2008 was they would hear about these email forwards, right? You know, Barack Obama is a Muslim. Barack Obama wasn't born in the United States. Some things even crazier than that. And the question was, this basic strategic calculation is, you know, do we respond? And political professionals, the folks that when we started covering campaigns had come up in an era of television and newspapers being the dominant way that politicians communicate with voters, they had a way of understanding the damage. So a bad story about your candidate on A1 of the Chicago Tribune might merit one response, but if it's only on B12, maybe we hold back and we don't give this more attention, right? If our opponent's putting 1,000 points behind this of television ads, maybe that merits one response, but only 500, we do something different. But when you just hear that something is circulating by email or now on TikTok or Facebook, it's hard to quantify the electoral impact of it. And so what the campaigns have gotten better at is developing some tools to try to understand the threat of any given piece of disinformation in electoral terms.
But isn't the news coverage of that still part of that calculation?
Yes. And folks in campaigns will probably tell you they think it's less important now than they did 15, 16 years ago. The Obama campaign was putting out that stuff in part because they wanted CNN or the New York Times to write a story that this thing is false. And this is both the cause and effect of the sort of disinformation epidemic, is that almost all media institutions are weaker now in our culture and our politics than they were 15, 20 years ago. And so, yes, there's still a big interest among campaigns to get, to the extent that there are referees, to say, this is correct, this is false. But part of the reason that that whole playbook existed was that the speaker of a lie in the sort of pre-digital era was somebody who would be responsive to bad news coverage, right? And so if your opponent lied about you, part of the reason you went to the newspaper to get them to say he's a liar is that
it might actually change their behavior.
And it might change the liar's behavior. Voters would respond to it. You could put it in a TV ad and said, you know, the editorial page of the, you know, San Francisco Chronicle says that he doesn't tell the truth. And I think for many politicians, the idea of being called a liar not that long ago was something they wanted to avoid. And I think part of it was that they were afraid that voters would respond to it, but also your donors, you know, might get a little less enthusiastic about raising money for you. And I think a lot of those incentives have disappeared for politicians, but so much of the major disinformation narratives of our time are not being generated or pushed solely by politicians. They're being pushed by people who not only aren't regulated as political entities, we often don't know their names, right? And that could be because they are in their basements trying to make mischief. They are teens in Macedonia who are creating fake websites because they have figured out how to sell advertising clicks on them. Or they could be from a foreign intelligence service. And none of those people care whether the editorial page scolds you for being right. a liar.
So what in your work on this book have you found that campaigns have found to be successful? I guess if you have these lie detectives, yeah. what are the examples of success that they've had?
Yeah, so I write about the Biden campaign in 2020, which was sort of blessed with something that's unusual in politics. They had a lot of money and a fair bit of time after he won the nomination. And so they set out this big research project in the summer of 2020 to identify what viral narratives were, as Rob Flaherty, who was the digital director then and is now the deputy campaign manager, called market moving. That was his term. And the idea is, look, people are all over the internet all the time making up stuff about public figures. Most of that isn't actually a worry for the campaign. They have their own strategic objective. They have what they want to talk about every day. They don't want to be dragged into, you know, playing whack-a-mole with whatever the latest thing that's trending on Twitter is. So they embarked on this big survey project, and they came up with a list of viral narratives that were circulating online. You know, Sleepy Joe, often they used Trump's nicknames for them. Sleepy Joe, which is, you know, the idea that Biden is old and mentally diminished.
So not, that's not a new line in the 2024 campaign.
Not a new line. Yeah. But, you know, and that's one that's come back in force, you know. One that was a big deal then and they were concerned about and has sort of disappeared is Creepy Joe, right? This was basically the claim that Biden is sort of touchy with younger women. Also things about Kamala Harris's backgrounds and relationships, things about Hunter Biden. And then they even, for these surveys, they made up some fake storylines. They call them red herrings, one of which was that Joe Biden was a member of a all-white country club, which is in no way true, but they used it to sort of create a baseline for reading these surveys. And they wanted to know, they asked voters one of two things. They wanted to know, are you familiar with this? And is it likely to affect your vote choice between Biden and Trump? And they mapped these on a graph with the answer to each question as an axis. And the farther you got into the upper right-hand corner, the more of a problem it was. And what they realized was that the reach of these is not the issue. I mean, often we have things that make it into the news, but they're circulating among Trump supporters or just spreading lies about Joe Biden because that's sort of the way you build
right.
and maintain
Some
community.
You could find people are very aware of, but will have no impact on their
yes.
vote choice.
And, you know, they're 8, 10, 11% of the electorate that's actually persuadable. And so the question is, among those voters, what has the reach, but also what is going to change their vote choice? And what they learned was, you know, the Hunter Biden stuff, a lot of people had heard it. But among the persuadable voters, it actually wasn't changing their opinions in the race. Focus groups revealed that these voters did not think that Biden was motivated by his personal financial gain.
Joe Biden.
Joe Biden.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hunter will not get 270 electoral votes. But the stuff related to Biden's age was actually an issue for them. And the focus groups revealed what it was, that these voters were not actually worried about Biden's physical fitness, but that they viewed him as a fundamentally weak political figure as one pollster said, they worried he was not going to be the author of his presidency and that they were worried that he didn't have strong views and other people were going to control him. There had been this sort of idea that the communications advisors have had, okay, voters are concerned about his age. Let's do photo ops of him bicycling. Let's show him running up the stairs of his plane. And this research project suggests that that's not really the issue here. They're not worried that he can't run. And so their answer was they started buying these Google ads. So when you search for Biden and senile, for example, you'd be pushed to a 10-15 second video of Biden just speaking to camera, unedited, about what he thought economic policy should look like. And it was part of a perception to think of disinformation not as a supply side problem where you're chasing the latest thing that pops up today, but a demand side problem, which is that the things that are a real concern are when voters bring pre-existing worries or anxieties about the candidate, let's prepare for the disinformation narratives that they will respond to.
We're going to take a quick break. More on combating disinformation in politics when we come back.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. There's been a ton of writing about the album Cowboy Carter since it dropped this spring. But what grabbed my attention is a new documentary on CNN called Call Me Country, Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Lots of artists have tried to boot scoot their way onto country music charts. Why did this album cause such a stir? And what about both this pop star and this political moment has caused all this conversation? Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
Welcome back. We're here with Sasha Eisenberg, whose new book, The Lie Detectives, is out now. I think I saw in one of your interviews, or maybe something you wrote, Sasha, in rolling out this book, did you say, or maybe somebody had put this on you, that it's sort of a bookend to what you did with the Victory Lab back in the 2012 campaign? Do you see this on a continuum?
Yes. I mean, I see it sort of many sequel follow-up bookend suggests that I'm done.
You're never done.
They keep pulling me back in. No, yeah. So I wrote this book in 2012 about innovation in campaigns, and it was pretty upbeat about especially the uses of data for campaigns, these experiments I write about. And, you know, largely it was the story of campaigns using technological advances to focus on motivating voters and tailoring information to their interests, which, you know, I ascribe some of the uptick in turnout rates and in electoral participation to the fact that campaigns were more invested in engaging voters with things other than sort of, you know, blanket TV ads. And I have had reason in the years since to think maybe I was a little naive. You know, what I think happened after 2016 was a lot of people started looking especially at online communication and realizing that there were folks who were intent on using the sort of tools of modern high-tech campaigning to dissuade people from participating and to confuse or mislead them. And it's become an ever bigger part of our politics. And so what brought me back to writing about sort of campaign innovation was it struck me a couple years ago that this was the most interesting new problem that campaigns are facing. And I was particularly interested by the asymmetry of it. Like in the Victory Lab, I was writing about, you know, two sides, Democrats and Republicans, who are sort of in this arms race for who can figure out the best micro-targeting tool or, you know, who can get a bigger improvement in their direct mail program. But they were all operating under the same constraints, right? And now this asymmetry where you're up against a foreign government or an anonymous person or somebody who is not actually in it to affect an election but is in it to create mischief.
Are you suggesting, though, that political campaigns are absent from the group of actors that could employ disinformation as part of their strategy?
Not at all. And we see plenty of examples of that. One of them is running for president right now. Oh. Is going to be the nominee of the Republican Party. But to some degree, when Trump lies, and there have been huge consequences of that. I mean, I think January 6th is a consequence of that. But we do have a kind of framework if you're a political opponent of his, if you're Chris Christie or you're Joe Biden, we have a political framework for how you try to hold him accountable. A lot of Donald Trump's lies, yes, some of them were in on Twitter back in the day, some of them are on Truth Social.
But now it's the life those lies take on in this universe.
Yes, no, absolutely. And that's in part because they can be spread and amplified by people who are not political actors, right? You know, my book basically starts in the aftermath of Trump's victory in 2016. And you have a lot of people in Democratic politics who, you know, were going through all the shock of trying to understand how Trump won. And a lot of them start focusing on what had happened sort of under their noses online in 2016. It's totally new. And so the book sort of opens with these people at the Democratic National Committee, at the AFL-CIO, and big donors on the left saying, like, you know, we need to talk to the people in Democratic politics who understand trolls and bots. And they find their way to this young woman, Jory Craig, who's 25 years old. She comes from Illinois, but she had been working for a Washington firm doing international work. And she had done campaigns in Moldova and Gabon and Panama and the Philippines. She had the relevant experience. Like, all this stuff that was sort of new to our politics, which is rumor being like an effective political tool, or having news organizations, media organizations that are partisan and ideologically motivated, foreign interference. Like, there are a lot of countries on Earth where this is just the norm and has been the norm even pre-internet. And so, you know, it's worth realizing that some of these shifts have been pretty disruptive to American politics in the last 8 years, but they're not entirely new to politics globally.
There's this term campaigns use, right? Relational organizing. And then using the internet as a way to go about doing that. You write that the internet, for its infancy in American politics, was largely transactional, right? And that it was just about raising money or amplifying the message of the day in some way, or putting it out on a social media channel. I mean, it's still about that, right? How do you see campaigns, both the Trump and Biden side, if you can, try to utilize it in this more relational organizing way that isn't just about organizing their supporters, but is also about beating back some of this?
Yeah, campaigns are largely command and control exercises. So the people at the top of a campaign spend a lot of money on research, policy research, opinion research. They decide exactly what they want to say, when, how, and to whom. And they don't want to lose control of what their message is. Which is why when volunteers show up in a field office somewhere, they don't tell them, hey, go talk to your neighbors about abortion. They say, you know, drop off these leaflets or read this script. And when the internet came along, campaigns had largely the same mentality, which is like, we'll ask you for stuff, but we're not going to ask you to spread our message because we don't trust you to spread our message the way we want it to be spread. And what has happened post-2016 is a lot of the folks who are doing this counter-disinformation work are starting to tell a story about why it is possible for not just an individual piece of content to take hold, but communities to develop around conspiracy theories. And I would say QAnon, I would say the 2020 election denial, I'd say COVID vaccine skepticism are all good examples of this. I think you look back at some of the great successes of online campaigning by politicians, and they created a lot of very weak ties, but not many strong ties. And in part, it's because they never, you know, Barack Obama has a massive contact list. He has a lot of people he can email and text right now. A lot of people who give money when he asks for it. But they're not well connected among each other, in part because Obama never relinquished the control of empowering them to communicate on his behalf. And the idea is that that has created both a void that these conspiracy theories are filling, but also has denied campaigns and politicians the ability to have trusted messengers who can push out responses to disinformation when it comes, because they never encouraged their supporters to basically develop and maintain relationships for the politician's benefit. And so there is
now— But you've seen a change.
There is a change now. You know, this idea of digital organizing is coming more into vogue. You know, for example, John Fetterman's campaign for Senate in Pennsylvania, they created a Slack channel where they have like 7,000 or 8,000 volunteers who spent all day like exchanging ideas for, you know, some of it's like memes and GIFs and like clapbacks, but like, hey, here's what you could be saying in the comments to defend then the lieutenant governor against attacks. And it wasn't mediated or controlled by their ad makers or their pollster. The Biden campaign is taking this a lot more seriously. There are volunteers right now who are getting trained in an app that encourages them to talk to their peers. And there's a risk, a cost in this that the campaign acknowledges, which is, yeah, some of our supporters are going to, like, probably say the quote-unquote wrong thing, right? You know, they're going to talk about how what Biden's going to do on abortion to some voter who's Catholic, and that's the one issue that might set them off. Or they're going to say, you know, the wrong thing about Israel and Gaza to somebody. And like the cost of not of continuing to see the internet as just a place to ask for money is that you cede the internet to people who are actually able to build relationships. And Trump is this almost accidentally. I don't think he ever had an electoral strategy around this. But what Trump started doing when he ran for office, especially on Twitter, first of all, he sent this message to his supporters like, hey, putting whatever thought you have in your head at any given moment is like good campaigning. And, you know, he shared and retweeted and amplified and endorsed.
Right. He basically, I mean, these campaigns, I think of them now in many ways as like content farms. They are their own content creators, right? And Trump basically said, the content you create, I'm going to incorporate.
That's right. Yeah. And he pushed out under his own name. And often it was not whatever the message of the day was going to be for his campaign. It's whatever Donald Trump found amusing or sort of useful at that moment. But it created this culture of his supporters feeling empowered to communicate on his behalf.
Has that been institutionalized now as a part of the strategic effort of the Trump campaign? Do you see the way in which they're organizing this 2024 effort around this?
I'm not sure they institutionalized as much as it's become part of the essential culture of MAGA, right? The way in which the campaign has encouraged, you know, people to make memes and GIFs. It started organically, but I think it's pretty clear they see this as one of their key assets. And in a sense, they don't need to institutionalize it as much because they have 8 years of online communities that are well-trained and people have relationships. They have bulletin boards. They have private groups. There's a whole ecosystem that would take years for a new candidate or for Biden, for that matter, to start building. And people are doing it organically. I think the challenge is, you know, some of what the Biden campaign is doing is, you know, paying influencers to do this. And some of that's just catch up because these are not people who necessarily were motivated to do it of their own accord before.
Wow. Sasha, before I let you go, I want to sort of end here where we started, which is you have walked me through the people who are in this space. You've walked me through how the 2020 example from the Biden campaign of identifying the problem of the age attacking. But to my initial question here, do you believe these campaigns are equipped to actually extinguish disinformation in this 2024 campaign, or it's a reality they just have to navigate their way through?
They are not extinguishing anything. They are at best mitigating and playing smart defense day to day and anticipating things. But everybody accepts that the problem is getting worse, mostly because the tech company social media platforms have backed away from some of their previous interest in moderating content. They see the scale of the problem is getting worse. The fears about what artificial intelligence will offer creates a whole new dynamic. The persistence of like private messaging apps like WhatsApp and Signal that allow no visibility from outsiders, TikTok, these are all things that weren't part of our politics in 2016 in a meaningful way. Everybody who is doing this work thinks it's harder. When I wrote the Victory Lab, I spent time with people who had defined some problems in politics and solved them. Over the course of working on this book, I spent time with people who had defined some what they thought were some major problems facing American democracy and possibly the world. And I saw my sort of main characters grow more and more fatalistic about whether anything they were doing is making a difference.
The book is called The Lie Detectives: In Search of a Playbook for Winning Elections in the Disinformation Age. Go get it, read it. Believe me, Sasha Eisenberg, unlike almost any other journalist covering politics, knows how to get underneath all the noise of a campaign and actually explain what these campaigns are doing day to day to win their effort. Sasha, thank you so much for being here.
Love talking to you, David. Thank you.
That's it for this week's edition of the CNN Political Briefing. And we want to hear from you. Is there a question you'd like answered about this election cycle? Is there a guest you really want to hear from? Give us a call at 301-842-8338 or send us an email at cnnpoliticalbriefing@gmail.com. And you might just be featured on a future episode of the podcast, so don't forget to tell us your name, where you're from, how we can reach you, and if you give us permission to use the recording on the podcast. CNN Political Briefing is a production of CNN Audio. This episode was produced by Madeline Thompson.
Our senior producer is Haley Thomas. Dan DeZula is our technical director, and Steve Lichtai is executive producer of CNN Audio. Support from Alex Manisseri, Robert Mathers, John Dianora, Lainey Steinhardt, Jamis Andrist, Nicole Pesaru, and Lisa Namero. And special thanks to Katie Hinman.
We'll be back with a new episode on Friday, March 22nd. Thanks so much for listening.